Our next guest arrived to Columbia a little early. He had a great show at the Nickelodeon Theater on Tuesday night, standing room only. He also spent some time in our film editing room. It was quite fun to see him in there, burning up the rewind. So everyone, please welcome Craig Baldwin.
Well, Frank Lloyd Wright is going to be a tough act to follow. I kind of feel like him, to be honest with you. Well, I am honored to be here, and it's good to keep this culture jamming program in mind, because I really must say that I come here really not so much as an archivist, really, but more as a very amateur collector, and not as a theoretician, but more of as a maker. And I think it's true that and fair to say that my presentation today will be more synthetic than analytic, so to speak. We'll try to draw some conclusions one way or the other, and we'll look at some films, that's for sure. Years back, I did make, and I will show clips from, by the way, a film on science and technology, by the way, which is one of the big reasons I'm presenting to you today. It was called Spectres of the Spectrum. It was made with earlier films of science and technology, not exactly in the form of a compilation doc, but really more in the form of what I'm calling a compilation narrative, which is a word that I made up, really. So basically, you're going to see a story. There's going to be some fictional parts, and I hope you'll bear with me. Sort of in between the artifacts from these fictional films. It could be described as part of my practice of a cinema povera, another word I made up, which is a sort of an impoverished cinema, that is to say, to make films out of what's really available. Availabilism, I call it. It's not really the luxury that I have to assess and retrieve, order, and certainly pay for materials from an archive. I just work with really what I have at hand. It's a kind of a folk art, a kind of a bricolage. Now, out of the very, very many components in my stock footage pool, I, over the years, became particularly interested, inspired, fascinated, one could even say obsessed, if that isn't too unhealthy a term, with a particular source material. In fact, a production that I had drawn from many, many years prior, by the way, in the late 80s, a film called Tribulation 99. And 16-millimeter black and white prints of this TV production were generally floating around filmmakers' garages and basements in the Bay Area for many years. And I had one or two prints. I never really knew what they were, to be honest with you. They were never complete, or many of them didn't have titles. I was drawn to it for the formal qualities, really. I didn't know much about the background of the production, the particular look of the kinescope, and that's really what I'm talking about right now, kinescopes, and particularly of the 50s. It's a film print of a live television broadcast, as I'm sure you know. Now, through informal inquiries, I came to learn that there was a larger, though still incomplete, set of these half-hour episodes actually held in the out-of-date section of the San Francisco Exploratorium Film Library. I certainly owe thanks to Liz Kime and Marina McDougall at the Exploratorium for finally liberating, maybe 10 of these titles from the forgotten back corners of the storage area. And I also managed to basically barter and trade for maybe another 10 other titles from other local makers. I cannot really say that any of the titles that I received were ever complete. Even as late as yesterday, I was discovering cement splices. I don't use cement splices, and I use tape splices. In these things, so there would obviously be many excisions over the course of many years. And in any event, whether or not they were complete when I received them, they certainly weren't complete after I was finished with them. I asked Dan to kind of keep me cordoned off from the rest of the film purists in the conference here. But I guess all I have right now is this podium. Well, anyway, bear with me. Now, you know, Liz Keim was originally slotted to make the presentation on Science in Action. You should know that. She had to cancel her trip here. And I really cannot substitute for her more formal and perhaps academic sort of background on the history of the series. In her absence, I can only fill in with most cursory and anecdotal type of details, and really going to be focusing more on my own repurposing or creative reuse of the material. All right. So my delivery to you, honored colleagues, will be more or less organized in these three movements. There'll be some brief prefatory remarks about the California Academy of Science, Dr. Earl Harold, and the series production itself. And the second section, maybe 13 minutes or so, will be 16-millimeter clips that we'll show projected, and what's what I'm calling a sampler from various of the episodes. And then the third part will be maybe 12 minutes of clips shown in two sections off of a DVD of my own derivative version, which is Spectres of the Spectrum. The California Academy of Sciences claims to be the oldest scientific institution in the West. That may or may not be true. It may be just bragging on San Francisco's part. But it's certainly famous, and I'm sure you've heard about it. It's located in Golden Gate Park. It houses the magnificent Steinhardt Aquarium, natural history wings with dioramas and dinosaurs, and until recently, a planetarium where you could see Lazarium, actually, a couple years ago. Perhaps many here can remember it as the aquarium scene in Orson Welles' Lady from Shanghai, in which he meets Rita Hayworth in 1947. Dr. Earl Harold is sort of the prime mover behind the whole series, you should know, and he came to the aquarium shortly after the war. He had gone to school at UCLA, UC Berkeley, and Stanford, earning his PhD in 1943. He was an avid diver, and he collected reef fishes all over the world, including Bikini Atoll after the A-bomb test there. He captured several new species of fish, wrote several books, including one that was translated into 11 languages, Living Fishes of the World. He discovered a lemon-yellow angelfish, newly named Centropia Heraldi, in his honor. He rose to prominence in these weekly shows, of which there were 626 episodes. Broadcast... weekly, by the way, on KGO, it's ABC, in San Francisco, time to compete opposite Mr. Wizard, which was NBC out of Chicago at that same time. Many adventures he had and many improvements he was responsible for the Steinhardt Aquarium. Of course, it grew to international prominence. If you've heard the... I guess you could say the urban myth, which you know I had heard for many years. It's true that he did actually tragically die at the age of 59 in January 1973, diving for fish off Cabo San Lucas. So you'll see a lot of Dr. Harold in this clip that I'm going to show right now. Science in Action, which was the series that he hosted, ran from September 51 to 1966, most of the shows were black and white, as you'll see, but in fact, there were a few, I don't know how many, they were in color. In fact, there's a clip in color that you'll see coming up that was broadcast to national audiences, not just in San Francisco. It was bicycled, I guess, is what they call it when it's transferred to film. Of course, you can move it around. There wasn't really videotape at that time that I know of, although someone might contradict me there, and it did reach a national audience on public and commercial televisions. Now, there's many episodes, and I wouldn't bore you with all the titles, but some are pretty interesting. Map Makers, Radar, which we'll see a lot of, Rivers of Ice, Submarines, Aero Medicine, which we'll see, Fluids in Motion, Science of Measuring, Science of Money, which is a good one. And many of these, I think, were a way to basically promote the military-industrial complex, frankly, and that's why I used it in my film, but I don't have to tell you that. I think that'll be clear to you. Many famous, of course, people would come in, both for the world of science and of military. We'll see both the Admiral Chester Nimitz and Chuck Yeager, the right stuff. a couple times, in fact, in these clips we're going to see in a second. I just have to make mention of a few of these titles that I don't know how they got in there. Cosmetic Surgery was one. The Sharks, Good and Bad, this sort of resonates with the earlier theme about the moral ambivalence, I guess you could say, of animals. Certainly whales, Superstition, which is one of my favorites, and these last ones, Mystery of Dreams, which would be a great one, and maybe that sort of coincided with the popularity of Freudian psychoanalysis, one would think. And then finally, this has obviously got to be the work of Dr. Harold, Submarine Animal Psychology. I would really love to see that one. I never had, though, but like I say, I only saw a very small percentage of them. Theodore Steinway of the piano fame was on it. Many other Bay Area professionals and academics, and many from UC Berkeley and Stanford. California Academy of Science aquatic biologist John McCoster, who's written a little bit about Dr. Harold, remembers the many, very fondly, by the way, the many mishaps that, of course, that it would occur. This was the thing, one of the things that drew me, of course, to the series is that it was in real time, you see. It was in early television, and it was a little bit of unintentional dada most of the time. When, you know, there were some really, really great moments. Of course, hopefully you'll be able to enjoy them. Now, McCoster says that Harold was always, you know, totally stoic and just, you know, kept a straight face and was very, maintained his equanimity through the worst kinds of disasters. One time a possum peed on Earl's white lab coat. Earl said, "It's a good thing television doesn't include smell-o-vision." Well, anyway, okay, so we're going to get on with the show. The thing is, again, I'm initially attracted the material because of the particular formal aesthetic qualities, the textural qualities of the kinescopes, the very primitive lenses and the vignetting of the frame. I think you'll notice, especially on the right side, the black halos that occur around some of the figures, but not all. I'm sure someone in the audience could tell me how that happens. I think it really had to do with the electron tubes in the video cameras at that time. But it's funny because there actually is a show, one of the episodes on transistors. So, you know, it's sort of like using a tube camera to report on transistors. And that's exactly the kind of doubling that I tried to exploit in my own film, by the way. The sort of silver halation you would get, again, because I think voltage would overmodulate in the receiving tube of the camera, and so it would go to a sort of a silver glare. I'm sure you're familiar with this phenomenon from the early kinescopes. The awkward camera moves, the weird lenses, and not to mention the fantastic signage, the graphics, the props, the models, the effects, and the wonderful black and white value shifts with some of the flashing lights that you'll see in a second. But above and beyond that, of course, the real-time performance, the awkwardness, and the sort of the early naive video art poetry that I tried to fold into my own show. So I guess we're going to really start with the reel now. Again, it's about 13 or 14 minutes. I actually will just yell this stuff out, if you don't mind, as it comes up. I certainly knew that we didn't have enough time for an entire half-hour episode. So what I did was, in the interest of taxonomy of sorts, I selected certain parts, features of every show, like the introduction and the main topic, and then the animal of the week and the preview of next week's show, and so on and so forth. So you'll see the original Science in Action intro, which probably was in the very early 51, 52, 53 period, in which you see an illustration of the California Academy of Sciences. Then there's, right after that, there'll be a little black leader, and then you'll see the later Science in Action introduction with in this case, an aerial photograph, not an illustration, of the California Academy of Science. And that's with the mission statement after it. And then there'll be a sponsor's message. And then you'll see one of my very favorites of the presentations of the actual topic, which is the flow of heat. And I've chosen this because it's a really lovely black and white look that I don't think you could possibly achieve with a motion picture film. It's some kind of effect of the kinescope, I would argue. And which then will, in that background of that, you'll see a mural illustration of the California Academy of Science. And then again, Black Leader, Chuck Yeager, Black Leader, Admiral Nimitz, Animal of the Week, the civet, and then another Animal of the Week. So, you know, like pick hits kind of thing, the gopher. Now, the gopher, I don't want to spoil this for you, but there's a really super treat for all of you into media archaeology when we come to the gophers. And then there's a wonderful preview of next week's program with a very groovy miniature antenna, and then directly into it. Then we'll go back out the same way we came in, first of all with the later outro and then the logo from Television Programs of America. This is a film presentation, it says, and then the earlier outro, just so you get the effect of the credits there. I don't have complete intros and outros because the films are shredded, but you'll at least see the name of Earl Harold, and that outro happens to be, by the way, from the Whales show, in which they barbecued a whale. That episode is again on the cutting room floor. Some of the sections are better than others. It's some of the stuff's thin, some of the stuff's second or third generation dupe prints, as they call them, and it's A and B wine. So there will be some wrangling with the focus, but I know that James and Luke can handle that. All right, and then I'll come up for air again and before to introduce my own work. So on with the show.
For another program in the award-winning television series, Science in Action. Science in Action is produced by the West's oldest scientific institution, the California Academy of Sciences. Now in its 100th year.
Thank you. May I pour you a cup of coffee? While I'm doing this, I'd like to mention a problem that has arisen. Now, I didn't plan to drink my coffee right now. What I had hoped to do was to drink it in a few minutes. So the question is, shall I add the cream now, or shall I add it later, say in about 5 minutes when I get ready to drink the coffee? Well, we can very easily make an experiment out of this by adding cream to one of them. Now, and then later, when we get ready to drink the coffee, we can test that against the other cup of coffee to which we will add cream at that time. Now, of course, there are those two cups of coffee in 5 minutes. I had difficulty remembering which one cooled off the faster. But fortunately, we have, as our guest on Science in Action, a scientist who has the answers to all such problems. I'd like to have you meet him. He's an old friend of our program, professor of physics at the University of California, Dr. Harvey E. White. How are you there, Harvey?
Evening, Earl.
Hey, can you help us with this coffee problem?
I'm not sure about all the answers, Earl, but we'll try on this one.
Fine.
Here's a little diagram made up of two cups of coffee. This one hasn't had the cream added. It's black yet. This is the one with cream that's been added. Now, this cup here is black. It started at the same temperature this one did. But being hotter, it cools off more rapidly. We can show that a little graph here. Oh, this represents the cup of coffee that's black. It cools off with time. So in about 5 minutes, 4.5 minutes, it's gone down almost to room temperature, but not quite.
This would be the time scale here in minutes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
That's right. Now let's look at this cup. The first thing we did was add cream.
Yes.
Right away, that cooled it down from this temperature down to about there. Mm-hmm. Then it started cooling, but being now cooler than the other one was, it doesn't give out as much heat per minute, and it follows a curve that looks similar, but always stays below the other one. It goes along like this.
Oh, yes.
But now don't forget, we haven't added the cream to this one yet.
Oh, yes, the first one.
So now if we add the cream here at this point, it cools down below the other one and goes on.
Oh.
So now if you want your coffee to be hot at the end of 5 minutes, are you going to add the cream first or at the end of the time?
Well, the thing to do quite obviously from this graph is to put the cream in first and at the end of 5 minutes do you'll have a hotter coffee than if you added the cream at the end of that period.
That's right. Just the opposite from what you might think.
Well, how does all this enter into the overall pattern of the transmission of heat?
Well, Earl, all of the various phenomena of heat transfer or heat traveling from one place to another can be classified under one of three classes of heat transfer, we call them. The first one is conduction, the second one is convection, and the third one is radiation. Now, conduction is a very, very slow process that takes place, as we'll see in our many experiments, over a period of time. It takes quite a while to conduct heat. Convection, however, is a more rapid process. But radiation is still more rapid, as we'll see later on.
Get above, say, about 46,000 feet, the rib cage won't support the pressure required to get this oxygen into the bloodstream, so this T1 pressure suit was devised. Now, on the leg, we carry a bailout bottle down here, which is not on this particular suit when you inflate your suit. Now, this suit we use like a parachute. There's no need to wear it around inflated if you have a pressurized cockpit, but if you should happen to lose a canopy, which we did in the one of our research airplanes at above 70,000 feet, then that's the only thing that can save your neck. And we're very fortunate in having, I'll cover this as the radio, and we have the microphone.
Well, that's your microphone right there.
Yes, he talks, and also your headset is on the inside of the helmet. And everything else is more or less just like a normal flying suit. You have incorporated inside a G-suit, which takes care of high accelerations. And there again, we're very fortunate in having people who look that far ahead of the requirements of pilots, both in pressure suits and energy suits, and they're doing a lot of study now on gravity-free flights, so it makes it makes a man feel pretty good when you're doing research flying to know that they're looking that far ahead of you.
One thing I'd like to ask you very quickly, our time is short, how fast have you been able to fly, or how fast can you tell us?
Well, we've been up to around 1,650 miles an hour in the X-1A. Mm-hmm. That was last December.
Oh, last December. Well, thanks very much for coming here to demonstrate this equipment, Major Yeager, and thank you very much for bringing all these things into the laboratory to demonstrate for us.
Thank you, Major, for coming.
Now, we'll be back in just a moment. Very pointedly, Admiral Lemus, I want to thank you for coming to Science and Action to be with us, bringing this fine material.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you and to join you in the program and to meet my old shipmate, Charlie Lockwood, who commanded our submarines so efficiently and effectively in World War II.
It's a great pleasure to be here to meet my big boss in the Pacific.
Oh, as well. Now, I want to say thanks to you, too, Admiral Lockwood. I'll be back in just a moment with the Animal of the Week. What will happen if I try to bring this tail out here to the shore? It's a very prehensile tail. You certainly know how to handle that animal. There you go. If you don't mind, I'll stand over to this side. I can see where that did disrupt something. He has a prehensile tail, though, and he uses that so that he normally comes down a tree head first. He seems to be a little bit rambunctious. Of course, Denny's never been on television before. That's certainly a beautiful animal. And I hope that you have so. How much did you weigh now? I want to ask you about
30 pounds.
Well, that's the first mineral that's ever been on television. So, Pete, I want to say thanks to you for bringing him over to us, and I hope you have good luck in his training in the future. Look at that wonderful fellow right now, actually, big fellow. Thanks very much, and we'll look forward to seeing him some other future time. And we hope that you'll plan to be with us on our next program. Thanks a lot. Front lawn, if you don't step very carefully, he'll know that you're there, although he may not be able to see you. Notice his very short tail. Now, that's quite important to the gopher. He's a little bit, didn't want me to demonstrate that tail. But notice how short it is. That's, of course, again, quite important to the gopher because it enables him to run backwards in the burrow. Well, he's washing himself there now. Oh, you cute little rascal. We usually want to get rid of them. Now, not all gophers have the appearance of this one. I'd like to show you some other color patterns. These are study stones. Now, in the western United States, they have a gopher that's quite different than the western one. Here are the two types. And the main difference is in the size of the principal differences between the eastern and western borders. Well, let's see what our fellow Dig is doing here again. This will be quite interesting, this. How often do you feed him, Bill?
Twice a week.
Well, he's really a good pet, and this is his normal cage that you keep him in. Well, I hope you'll keep us advised as to how Dick does in the future, and thanks very much for bringing him to Science in Action. Now, here's a type of equipment that we'll have an opportunity to examine a little bit more closely on our next program when we look at our radar defense system. Our special guest on the program at that time will be Brigadier General Andrew of the U.S. Air Force. We hope you'll find the U.S. there. Thanks a lot.
We're going to keep rolling, but turn the audio off, and this will show you some of my source reels, high-con negative stuff. There's actually some re-photography coming up here, which is not exactly the same thing as just optical printing. It's shooting really off of a screen, so you get the flicker of the shutter. Okay, again, not to apologize. Thanks for just putting me through that. We actually got to go to the DVD now, you guys. So I just added that on just for treat. But anyway, we have to go to the – this is a color kinescope, in case you're interested. I wasn't really intending on showing this. But I've never really seen a water damage Kodachrome color kinescope before. But anyway, I've been told we don't have that much time. So can we just go to number 15 and forget the number 5? Yeah, so anyway, obviously that little last section there was just an attempt to bridge between the original source material and my final product to show you some of the source intermediary source reels that I was using as I was developing a kind of the grammar of the new film, because I intended on using those as kind of a grammatical paragraphing. But anyway, here we go.
Wait till you see this. It's the latest portable model.
Hey, it's a teleporter.
Very good, Mark.
I don't get it.
It's a teleporter, a time warp machine. It can transport you through time and space.
Great. Let's see, 1978, 77, 1976. Mark 6,
world of high fidelity. Real audio components together in a matched stereo system. A sound that's really sensational.
Not the 70s again. I've got to go still farther back.
It's the premature arrival of the future. And for those who are unprepared, its effects can be pretty devastating.
You are about to know the thrill of seeing that which has never been seen before.
Dr. Harold?
Thank you.
In color?
You're about to enter a beautiful, exciting, wonderful new world. The world of 1960. For the first time in history, you'll see...
You are there.
1957.
Today, and it's Wednesday, November 20th, 1957.
Missiles, anti-missiles, and electronic devices that might make anti-missiles, missiles, ineffective. I think I better try that again. Because it's true, it's important, and it's complicated. And all of those things you have to get these days. Those three things are being discussed in the Pentagon at secret meetings.
One of the developments making these new weapons possible is the reduction in size of electronic components like the transistor.
Yes! Finally, I'm there! I found the lost episode!
From the David Sarnoff Research Laboratories of the Radio Corporation of America, I'd like to have you meet him. He's Dr. Schuyler Christian.
Yes, RCA scientists have been conducting research in electronics since 1920. Now turn.
Now, that is quite interesting, but how does all that work?
You can turn this one off, you can regulate the volume, you can use it in a canoe. Turn the volume off. And so, as we enter the era of the electronic brain, which will be built out of transistors, you might well say that we're entering the true era of the transistor.
Well, you certainly...
Where is she?
What the future is going to be?
David Sarnoff, chairman of the board of RCA, said science and electronics are moving so fast that in 10 years, even these things will mostly be obsolete.
Oh, I might mention that Miss Amy Hackett, our technician over there, is going to do the same thing on regular scale.
Grandma... But where would she have stored the secret?
The transistorized model is smaller and lighter. Let's turn it on.
To short-circuit the Pulse Project, wish upon a solar flare. Brainstorm at hydrogen spin rate, and let the order beware. Brainstorm at hydrogen spin rate? Could she have meant... transmit telekinetic waves precisely at the specific resonant frequency of the hydrogen atoms in the sun's core? That would radically accelerate its thermonuclear fusion process, triggering a colossal coronal mass ejection. That gargantuan glob of piping hot plasma will streak towards Earth's poles at 1,000,000 miles per hour.
That could be groovy.
Okay, well, anyway, that's it for that. So, yeah. You had to see a lot of the films besides Science and Action in that little montage there, though, but it's through and through the whole 90 minutes of the show. So anyway, are we going to have a Q&A now or whatnot?